being a token isn't like I choose it. It's what's being done to me. Our only response to that is, how can I make this a better opportunity going forward? How can I make sure that I'm actually changing the organization? So when the doors open and my voice is heard, that I have to use that voice. You know, that's one of the hardest things about being the first, is that you are going to be by yourself, but hopefully you do in fact make change.
Welcome to Conversations at Basecamp, the professional development podcast designed to help you confidently ascend the corporate climb. I'm Kim Havens.
And I'm Noah Reese, and we're the co-founders of Kahila, a digital platform providing leadership development for people on the rise.
This podcast is your exclusive look into our Basecamp for intentional career growth.
Each week, we'll dive into essential topics to master high-impact power skills, and we'll also decode leadership secrets and navigate game-changing trends to future-proof our careers.
So, whether you're a seasoned professional seeking to refine your approach to leadership development or an ambitious person charting your course, Conversations at Basecamp empowers you with actionable insights and tangible takeaways.
Hello there, everyone, and welcome back to Break the Barrier, the leadership development and executive coaching experience brought to you by Kahila. Of course, you know, my name is Raphael Saul, honored to be your program facilitator for this executive coaching program, especially for men of color. It's really exciting today to welcome Mr. Jason Thompson. He is the VP of DEI for Western Governors University and co-founder and senior DEI advisor of CAPE Inclusion. He brings 25 plus years of experience in diversity, equity, and inclusion, equality and inclusion, community outreach, program management, strategic planning, and public relations. He's the author of Diversity and Inclusion Matters, Tactics and Tools to Inspire Equity and Game-Changing Performance. He's developed and led award-winning diversity programs in higher education, sports, healthcare, and tech, including the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee. He's the co-founder of CAPE, CAPE Inclusion, a minority-owned DEI software solutions company. It really is an honor for us to have the opportunity to sit and spend some time chatting with a true rock star in the DEI space. A huge welcome to you, Mr. Jason Thompson. Welcome to the platform.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's great to be here.
Oh, it really is a pleasure. As we hear your bio, as we look at your experience, Jason, you have a tremendous amount of experience in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space. And we know that this program, one specifically designed for men of color, it connects very intricately with that theme of embracing minorities and embracing, in our case, men of color, who are sometimes faced with that glass or concrete ceiling as they're trying to climb the corporate ladder. A big question I had as I looked at 25 years of DEI experience in the corporate world is, where does this passion and this zeal for diversity, for inclusion in the corporate space or even beyond, where does that come from for Jason Thompson?
Yeah, you know, I'm lucky because I'm returning a favor. You know, it's interesting, the topic here being mentorship. My first job out of college was with a diversity officer. And she found me when I was undergrad. I actually flunked out of college. So I'm a terrible student. I'm flunking out. I'm actually dyslexic. I didn't know I was dyslexic. Wow. So I'm terrible in school. And somehow she finds me. She gets recently hired as chief diversity officer at the University of Wyoming, of all places. And she hired me. And then when I graduated, there was a coordinator position in her office open. So she hired me to do that. And I had to send an email out to the department. And it was terrible. My writing was terrible. Okay. And she said to me, I will mentor you. Every time you have to write an email, you send it to me first. I will edit and then I will send it out. So she edited all my work. And then I just started paying attention to the errors because I kept making the same errors. And I'm returning that favor because she was the difference in my career. Because looking back on it, there's no way I could have kept a professional job because my writing was so terrible. And I didn't know why it was terrible. And I didn't actually know I was dyslexic. So it's just, I just couldn't make differences in words and things like this. But it's that moment of her taking time with me. And I remember, this is kind of an interesting side, but she hires me and I hire this student to work for us because we always hire students, you know, students of color specifically. Mm-hmm. We hire a student who's indigenous from one of the local reservations in Wyoming. And he'd show up every morning. He'd put his feet up on the desk and he'd eat like two donuts and drink like a liter of Mountain Dew, literally.
What?
And then wait. And this, I know, this is how he woke himself up. And so I go to Dolores, my mentor. I was like, okay, we got to fire this guy. He's terrible. And she said, no, this is what we do. This is what we have to do as people of color, help each other, because his parents never had a professional job. He doesn't know. And if you don't tell him, how's he ever going to know? That's our obligation. That's how we make change, right? And so I learned from that. And I'm just returning that favor. Like, that's what we do. Like, you have to be explicit. And he had no experience in that space. And if I don't take that time, and if she hadn't taken the time with me, my career would have been totally different. I'd probably be working in a very manual labor job. Not that anything's wrong with manual labor jobs, but it would have been an obligation, would have been a choice. And she gave me choices. So I appreciate that. And I'm returning the favor to answer the question. That's where it comes from. I'm just simply returning a favor.
I love that. This theme of like paying it forward, right? Paying it forward all the time. So what I'm wondering, Jason, for you, what were those moments like where maybe in the early days of your professional career, you were the only person of color in the room, or maybe one of few persons of color in the boardroom or at the conference? It's an experience that I think as men of color, Indian American, Asian American, in different spaces, we have to navigate. What would you say are some of the keys to being able to stand in your own power, to deliver as you need to, even when you are looking around you and you're seeing nothing else or no one else who looks like you or sounds like you?
Yeah, you know, I was lucky because my first boss and my mentor, essentially, we would go to meetings together. And I was University One, so you can imagine, University One, very isolated, not a lot of people of color at all. There was no African Americans. So we would go to a meeting. And afterwards, she'd decompress the meeting. She said, did you watch so-and-so, Professor so-and-so? Did you see what he said? Do you understand what he said? And I was like, I don't know. You know, she was like, you got to need to pay attention. You got to do this. And, you know, she would just point little things like, Jason, show up with a pad and a pen to every meeting, which seems like overly simple, but my parents had working class jobs. They didn't, you know, we were very poor. So there was nobody in my circle to tell me these things. Mm-hmm. And so it was nice because she pointed out very fundamental things to do, like, make sure you're paying attention, write down. Even if you don't think it's important, just look like you're paying attention. Even though it seems overly simple, it was things that you needed to know, because I had always worked, you know, like at a grocery store or whatever. You know, I had manual labor jobs. So it was just so helpful that she would just point these things out, very just like, don't do this, don't do that. Did you see so-and-so? This is how he's working the room. So-and-so is very good at that. You should pay attention to these things. And so that was very helpful. And then as I proceeded in my career, it becomes more isolating, to be honest with you. Like you, I mean, I would say most companies, I got to the vice president level and there would be two things against me. One is, I wouldn't say against me, but you know, it's isolating. There's no people of color but me generally, but also they know each other. Like they're from the same network. I'm not in that network. And so typically what happened is I got the job because they needed a diversity officer and there was nobody in their network. So they didn't hire somebody. So not only, you know, am I isolated in the sense of we have no shared background? Like I am the only person of color, very visibly. And then we have no shared history. They would go back, oh, we worked at sets and sets together. That's how we met. You know, they had this whole history. And I find that almost at every company I've ever been to, when you get to the senior level, I'll see all the other people who are VPs are connected and I am not. And so it's super isolating. But, you know, your question, I think is a good one. Like I have accepted a certain amount of imposter syndrome as normal. And to be a little political here is, I hope to never be Donald Trump walking in a room, like no sense of self and thinking I'm great at everything. Like to a certain degree, I think you should check yourself. Like periodically go, I don't even know that good at this. Like I should take advice. They like always be open to that. It's helped me. Like I have stopped fighting this thing. I'm like, to me, that's the normal response. You should check yourself periodically. Like, yeah, I'm not sure, you know, check my skills. Am I good enough or whatever? Yeah. Generally what I find is you are. And the piece of strength I always take is from a woman who was a wrestler. So I worked in the Olympics, right? And they bring in the speaker and she's a wrestler on the women's team. And she's wrestling apparently this Japanese woman who hadn't lost in like 14 years.
Right.
She said, I felt very insecure. I keep looking at this woman. She said, this woman warmed up doing things she had never seen before. And this was like for the gold medal. And she said, so he looks at her coach. He says, you know, like, what are we going to do? Like this, you know, look at the stuff she's doing. I can't beat her. You know, are you kidding me? And then she said, then I paused for a minute and I realized I am enough. That's all I can do. I am enough. And she ended up winning, you know, it's a great story and all that. But I remind myself that sometimes, like, you don't have to have every skill, but just pause for a minute and go, I am enough. I am enough. And sometimes I just do that exercise before walking in the room. Like, I know I'm going to go, I'm the only Black person. I experience a lot of passive aggressive behaviors where everything I say is questioned or repeated back to me like I don't understand. And I have to respond in a way that, and many times sacrificing who I am to do that, you know, it's insulting to me and I can't say it's insulting. I have to act like this is professional behavior when it's not. And so, yeah, I do the exercise of just saying I am enough and going in there. And, you know, I think of my children sometimes, like if I do this, they don't have to. Like there have been sometimes jobs where I was like, but I don't want to quit. I'm not putting up with this. And then I realized, no. I got to pay the bills. Kids got to eat. But if I do this, they won't have to. Like, that's the goal. Like, hopefully I make some change every day I'm at work. Just a little bit of change.
Yeah. I love that, Jason. Something you said there, it's like you're about to walk in the room. You know you've got it figured out. You know you've prepared. But there's just that underlying voice you're always battling and fighting that says, maybe you can't, maybe you shouldn't, maybe they won't understand, maybe they won't receive you. I'm going to constantly fight that all the time. And I'm borrowing that. I want to encourage all of our Kahila Knights to borrow it as well. That affirmation almost, that we are enough before we're going in. So Jason, you're African-American, Japanese, is that correct?
Yes.
So one of the things that we talk about a lot is the impact of our family of origin or our background. So we have these interesting conversations around growing up Black meant this as it relates to work. Growing up Asian meant this as it relates to work. You sort of brought both of those things together. And I'd love to know how that impacted sort of your journey from a corporate perspective.
Yeah. So I guess my story is interesting. I was actually born in Japan and my mom's Japanese. My mother couldn't read and write in English. So when I struggled in school, she couldn't help me. And so I struggled in school all the time. And I have no memories of my mother ever helping me with homework because literally she could not. Now, my mom was a brilliant woman who actually had a degree from Japan and she could speak 7 or 8 languages. She just could not read and write English, which was interesting. Wow. So she could speak it, but she struggled with it. And so as you can imagine, she writes like not even equivalent to a kindergartner. It was very remedial. She could barely write her name in English. And so the challenge here for me as a person of color is then we moved to Wyoming. So you can imagine. This is even more bizarre. My dad was in the military. They move us essentially from Japan, Hawaii. So I went to kindergarten in Hawaii and then Wyoming. And they chose Wyoming because they thought it would be safer than Texas. We were originally assigned to go to Texas, but because my parents were biracial, a lot of people don't realize like interracial relationships were basically, I think, made legal in 67 or something, 68. I was born in 67. So their marriage, I'm not even sure was even legal, to be honest with you. And they did not feel like we would be safe in Texas. And so they chose, which is even more bizarre, like Wyoming. But you grew up in Wyoming, there's few people of color, almost no African-Americans. But I'm not accepted in the Black community because I'm not Black. I'm biracial. And Black people know. They can tell right away I'm biracial, right? I'm not accepted in the white community. And there are literally no Asians in Wyoming, at least at that time. And so it was extremely isolating. I have two brothers, two older brothers and a sister. I have a brother about a year older. We were very close because we were basically it. And we would go to most schools. We'd be the only people of color. And of course, poor. I mean, and I remember going to school with shirts that my brother stole. Like that's how we got clothes. So it was, when I say poor, and I didn't realize how poor we were. You know, my dad, we always lived beyond our means. So he would get these amazing homes we'd live in that we couldn't afford. You know, they were nice homes, middle-class homes, but we were not living a middle-class life. So I would start school with maybe 2 shirts and that was it. Like, and my mom, she was very much about washing clothes. The clothes were clean, but it's it. But it's very isolating because you go to school. There were probably no other kids of color in the school, in elementary school. Middle school, there were, but I wasn't really very accepted by African-American children. There are no Asian kids, and I don't look Asian, so I can't, you know, and then the white kids, they don't accept us either, so it's extremely isolating. The only upside of that experience is it does help me to this day, because you can imagine, I go to corporate rooms, I'm the only person of color, I'm like, second grade, you know, that's a Tuesday. Yeah, been there, done that. And so on that level, it's helped me in a weird sort of way because I'm probably more comfortable being by myself, isolated by that. But, you know, my origin story is one of never really being Japanese because I don't appear to be Japanese. But also there was no Japanese culture, so it wasn't even an option. And then kind of growing up, then that era was like, it's a melting pot. Like if you just melt in. And I remember when I was young, even being ashamed of my parents, like I just don't want anybody to see my parents because I don't want people to think I'm different. I'm trying to melt in. And I think that's one of the unintended consequences of this concept of melting pot. Because what it does is almost encourage of you being ashamed of who you are and acting like that stuff doesn't exist. And that's actually not helpful. And the one thing that probably helped me is my oldest brother, that guy, he was just like, yeah, I'm Black and Japanese. He was so proud of it. It helped me grow a sense of confidence because he was almost cocky about it. Like, any roommate, yeah, I'm Black and Japanese. What you want to know? You know, that's how he was. And I remember envying him wanting to be, I want to be that person. So it was helpful that I had him as a role model actually growing up because he seemed very comfortable. And I was the opposite. Like, I'm just trying to melt in. I don't want to be seen. Don't look at my parents, you know? And so it took a little while for me to grow into that and accept, you know, who I am. But I do think that's one of the unintended consequences of this concept of melting pot. It does make you feel like you should be ashamed of who you are because those things are somehow bad and you should look like everyone else. Well, that wasn't possible for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's really, really good. It does make me think, before we go to the point of mentorship, which I really want to get to, do you end up from a personal or professional perspective thinking, you know what, whatever I do, I'm going to prove them wrong? Because there were so many thems that second-guessed you, thought you weren't capable, that maybe prejudiced you in some way. Do you grow up or start your career even thinking that way?
Yeah, I would say it was helpful because I was like, I'm not that stereotype and I want you to think of that. And it just like this chip. And I remember, like I told you, I flunked out of college. And so one of my most vivid memories, so I flunked out of college. And so my brother says, well, you can apply to get back in. So I did. And they let me in part-time. And so I took a Spanish class. And so the first day of class I go and I'd heard, well, if you sit in front, you'll do better. So I thought, well, I'll sit like second row. And we're in this big auditorium, about 300 people in an introductory Spanish course. And the first question is, has anybody taken Spanish before? Are you taking this course again? Are you retaking it? Right. So I'm literally like second row. I raise my hand. We're in this auditorium. And she walks right over to where I'm at and looks me right in the eye and said, well, who'd you take the course from? And I said, Professor Adams. She said, if you took Professor Adams' course and you couldn't pass his, you will never pass my course. She literally announces it to the class. Right?
Oh,
and luckily, I grew up with a chip on my shoulder. And I was like, okay, it is on. I showed up every day. I sat in the same chair. I looked her right dead in the eye and I was like, and my only regret is I got a B in that class. I should have got an A, but you know, it actually helped me. It was a gift because the fact she picked that fight and I'd always been like, everybody thinks less of you and they always think you're less than in every room you go into, people question it. It helped me. I think if she hadn't have done that in a weird sort of way, it wouldn't have like motivated me like, okay, yeah, every day I'm going to be in this room in your face, learning Spanish and showing you I can get this done. And I had to take a part-time job. I mean, it was a lot to take on to be that. I don't know if the word's cocky, but it's like you say, it's this confidence that you have to get when everyone's always doubting you.
Yeah.
Always thinking you're less than. It has helped me. Like I needed her to pick that fight. And I don't think she intended that way. But either way, it's demeaning. I don't know why you'd want to announce that to a classroom, but it was super helpful. I'm sure I got to be because of it, you know, so.
Yeah. No, I love that. I love that. And I think it's an interesting and welcomed narrative. I think sometimes our narrative is they're just all these things working against us, which are true. We're not sort of downplaying that fact, but it's how we shift our perspective on those things in the way that you did. And I want to jump to our substantive, sort of the heart of the discussion today, which is around mentorship. One of the discussions that we've had, and you opened us up beautifully by talking about how your mentor sort of led the way for you. One of the things we've talked about a lot on the platform is about getting a sponsor, sponsorship. How can I get someone in my organization to sponsor me, to, you know, to talk up for me, to promote me, to submit my name, recommend me for a particular promotion or opportunity? And I think there's sponsorship, but mentorship could potentially be broader. I mean, maybe there's a mentor within your organization who's not in a position to sponsor you. Or maybe there's a mentor outside of your organization at all, someone else in your industry. So I'd love to get your perspective, Jason, on, yes, we need to get good sponsors in order for us to grow in a particular organization or even in an industry. But more broadly, how does that interplay between sponsorship and mentorship sort of come to be? As far as you can tell.
You know, for me, I think mentors have conversations with you about things that are not explicit, that are implicit in an organization and help you pick up those cues as you go along in your career. So I think you're right. Like a sponsor would go, we're talking about promotions and they hopefully bring your name up.
Yes.
A mentor to me says, you got a call from a headhunter, take that call. Like this is how it works to get to the executive level in your career. And, you know, I was lucky because the first person who was a mentor to me wasn't really about the sponsorship advocating from other rooms. She would just say very fundamental things to me. When you go to this meeting, do that. Take a pen, you know, read the cues in the room. This is how you read the cues. Because I grew up, you know, basically poor, working class family. And My dad never had these skills. My mom didn't have these skills. So there's no one to teach you. And I think too, when you grow up that way, a mentor is like, that's brown nose. Why are you brown nosing with the boss? Why are you doing this? Like, that's almost demeaned. And so you have to overcome that. I think many times, even in communities of color, we do this, all right? Oh, you're just brown nosing with the boss and not realize, no, that's how things get done. A mentor helps you learn the things that aren't said in a workplace. I remember she told me, like, just watch the behavior of leaders because that's how they got there and read the cues. And I remember years ago, I worked with this guy and I got promoted over him. He was a white colleague. And right before I left, he said to me, well, Jason, how do you get there? How, you know, he just literally said, I don't think this is fair. Like, our careers are equivalent. Why'd you get it? I didn't. And I said, it's because you're very funny, but no one promotes the class clown. And I said, your jokes, that's the problem. It was brutal. He is now VP. And I was like, just think about it. Like, you're always cracking jokes. It's funny. And I said, the other thing is, look at the CEO. He never wears facial hair. You walk around with a beard. Have you noticed none of the other leaders wear beards? And luckily, my first mentor told me these things, how to pick up on those cues. That's what you need a mentor to tell you. Okay, this is how you read the culture of the organization. You know, align yourself with those things if you want to do well here. And if you don't like those things, then maybe you go somewhere else. But because she just told me those little just skills, like, if everyone else is writing on a pad, you should have a pad, right? Like, these are the leaders what they do. If they bring their laptop to the meeting, you bring your laptop. You know, like, it doesn't matter. You could memorize everything. It's just that you have to mirror the behavior of the leaders because that's the culture. To me, that's the difference between a mentor and a sponsor. To me, a sponsor helps when you're not in the room. They go, oh, I think Jason's great. You're looking for a new VP and I recommend him. And mentorship, that's the difference. I mean, there's several people now that I mentor in a way. And I remember, and I alluded to this, she called one day and I had recommended her for a job. I had her called me and she said, oh, I don't want that job, Jason. I didn't take the call. And I was like, no, that's not how it works. I was like, you just need to be in the circle with headhunters because they're going to recommend you for jobs. And the way you negotiate for a senior level position is different than being a director. And you're a director, you want to be a VP. Like, and so I just started explaining the skill set to her. Like, this is how it works. They're going to do this. They're going to present you, blah, blah, blah. And she had never worked with a headhunter before. So that conversation is what a mentor does for you, is have that conversation. Like, this is why you use a headhunter. When they contact you, this is why you take the call. Even if you don't want the job that you need to, you know, and just explain that. Yeah. And now she makes twice what I do. She got a major promotion. And I was like, okay, that's how mentorship should work. Like, in communities of color, this is a young African-American woman. Her parents had never had these. She's like, no, I never worked with a headhunter before. She didn't know how it worked. That's what a mentor should do, is like, tell you, these are the rules. How do you identify the rules? This is how you're going to negotiate that room, those kind of things.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I want to jump to this question. How do you suggest creating connections with people that do not have surface level similarities? So they're not of the same race, gender, et cetera. But from a mentorship perspective, I see value there in creating such a connection.
Yeah, I think you should have several mentors. And I'll say this, I am completely socially awkward. I just am. I'm not good with people. I'm awkward. I'm clumsy. If you ever meet me one-on-one, you'll see Jason is not good interpersonally, right? So I'm coming. So for me, mentorship has never been, other than my first mentor, it's always been, I just take different things from different leaders. So there was a CEO years ago that I worked for. I thought the man was brilliant. So whenever I had an opportunity to be in his space, I was just around him and I just intuitively picked up on how he walked. I would just watch how he manages the room, different things that he did. I don't know that he would ever say I was his mentee and he was my mentor. We didn't have this formal relationship. But I tried to build it in the context of who I am. I've had other people who I'm like, you know, I couldn't do it that way, but I'm glad to see how they do it and to see where they are in their career. And I just try to take mental notes in different spaces, in different ways, and pick up the cues. I don't know that I've had a lot of mentors, but I've had a lot of people who they didn't know they were mentoring me. Like, I just, I'm socially awkward. So I just own that. Now, for some people, it might be you have this formal thing and you reach out to them. Can you mentor me? And the whole nine. So maybe that works. Or maybe, and you'll see this quite a bit, as an African-American, who I present as African-American, I can't negotiate the room the same way many of my white peers do. Like, you can't have any emotion. I remember once I had a boss, I was very adamant and direct about something going on. And she said, oh, that was so scary. You got to tell me in advance. And it was such a reminder of, and I was like, okay. And I had some other friends in the room and they were like, no, you weren't. She's just afraid of Black people. That's literally what's going on. Wow. So as a Black male, I know that for many of my white male friends, they can do things in rooms that I cannot. That's just a reality. Now, it doesn't mean they're terrible, negative people, but they get a larger range of emotions than I get as a Black person because people are afraid of us, right? They see you, they're afraid of you. So I realized that I have to negotiate the room differently, but it doesn't mean I can't learn from people who have a different skill set or history. You know, one of the things, his name was Stan Hupfeld. He was the CEO of the healthcare system. The man was brilliant. Mm-hmm. And I can't negotiate the room the way he did, but I could take his advice. Like he would say, you can't save your way to prosperity, he would always say. And that's how he would dress the CFO, because CFO was always like trying to save money somewhere. And that was his response. And sometimes he would just be like, no, we're going to do this. But to me, what I learned is when you are the boss, there's sometimes you just have to be the boss. You don't have to be angry or yell, but just know this is my position. This is my positional authority and use it. And that's what he did many times. He did it differently. But what I learned from him is there are times where you really have to own the space. There's sometimes where it's negotiable and sometimes where it's not. And it's okay not to be. We might do it differently. You know, for him, he could show anger. He could just back down the CFO. Right. I know that I couldn't, because of how it would be received. But I also knew fundamentally the principle's the same, right? That there are certain times where I had to push back. I'm like, no, we're going to do it this way. He's doing his job, which is to save money. My job is, look, certain things have to happen in the context of diversity. So I tried to still learn from that and take the principles, not always in this formal mentorship, but in the context of trying to learn the fundamental principles of how to negotiate the organization.
So good. So it sounds to me that you've not only been able to identify people who have characteristics or who exhibit behaviors that you can mirror or model or learn from, but also the part of the discussion I want us to get to know is, what are the attributes of a good mentee? Because it sounds to me, Jason, that at different stages in your journey, you were able to benefit from good mentors because you figured out how to be a good mentee. I remember hearing a coach say once, there's some people, literally, after I've shared with you certain advice and guidance, do not come back to me until you've implemented the things that I've shared with you. I'm not going back around the circle with you. So what would you say are some of the key attributes that have made you a good mentee and that us as mentees can incorporate into our professional journeys?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that I try to, and we all say like, be a good listener or whatever. Obviously be a good listener. But I think what the thing is, and you alluded to this, is are you willing to change your behavior? Like a lot of times people are like, well, I'm a good listener. No, actually what they're asking you to do is change your behavior. And that's why I think it's good to have a certain amount of maybe questioning or, you know, we have all these terms for you, insecurity about your job. Like, is it imposter syndrome? Like, that's why I just started accepting. Imposter syndrome probably means you're a normal human who periodically needs to check themselves and go, you know what? Maybe I'm not doing this the best way. That's completely normal. And for me, I've accepted that, which also means I'm a good mentee, because when people tell me things, I'm like, okay, you know, let me pause for a minute and accept that. Is there a different way I could do it? And, you know, I think that's what has to come with it, is a certain amount of humility, because to me, sometimes imposter syndrome is what humility would look like. Like, maybe I'm not perfect. Maybe I'm not the best VP. Maybe you're right. Like, I should just pause for a minute, accept the advice. Because sometimes, and I've done this early in my career too, I confuse confidence with being a great leader. And as a result, I wasn't a good listener. I was like, oh, I'm making a decision. I remember years ago, I worked at the Olympics and they had this program. And I was like, we got to change the program. And I was very adamant about it. And my decision actually was the right decision, but my cockiness turned everyone off to me. Like, all the people who wanted to support didn't want to support me. Mm. And in the end, we finally had a good conversation because I listened and said, you know what? I hear you. What you're saying is, we like the direction, but you're saying things to us are demeaning. The way you're going about it is so wrong. And once I accepted that and I could say that aloud to them, I had complete support. So you don't have to be cocky or overconfident to make a decision. Like, you can actually do both at the same time. And I think that's what helped me be a good mentee, is just, it's not just the listening, but actually, you know, reading the room, adjusting my behavior, responding to what I see. You actually need to do both. The confidence sometimes is over relied on. Like, I think as a leader, I got to be confident. And it's like, no, actually, if you're a good leader and you make a good decision, people will support you if you can show that openness to listen.
So on the point we were talking about just before you responded just now, Jason, the frustrated mentor who may be like, though it doesn't sound to me like she was very frustrated when she was coaching you on your emails and reading the room and so on, but the frustrated mentor who is sort of pouring in, who is trying to coach, who's trying to guide, but isn't getting the level of traction, if I can use that term, sure, that he or she wants to get. Perhaps there's a sandwich effect. I think that participants in some cases might be mentors, yeah, and in many cases might be mentees who are interested in growing and going to the next level. So how have you managed that that mentor frustration, which can occur from time to time.
Yeah, I think sometimes you got to create space for people to fail. Just let them fail. And that has been very helpful to me, which sounds terrible, but we learn from failure. And sometimes if you always prevent that failure, they're actually not learning from that, because until it happens, then they go, oh, I've actually learned from this failure. And so sometimes I think as a mentor, you got to create space and allow people to fail. And I've actually learned mostly from my children to do this, because a lot of times with their kids in particular, you're trying to protect them so much that you don't give them a space to fail. And actually they can learn from that, and you can be a better mentor to them, because now it makes sense. You know, if you can go, I wouldn't do that if I were you, but go ahead and try it. And then if it does fail, it might work. Like, you could actually be wrong. And that's another thing as a mentor too, you got to accept you could be wrong. Like, your advice might not be good. But I have learned that creating space for people to fail actually helps them learn. And I have learned the most. I remember I worked in this hospital system, and the boss I had was a very good mentor to me. We didn't have this formal mentor conversation, but I remember I went to her because I had to draft an email. Apparently I'm terrible at emails, obviously, because of my dyslexia, and it had an error in it, but I had to write it for the CEO. So this email goes out from the CEO to 10,000 employees, but I had written it and had a major error in it. So over the weekend, I couldn't sleep because it went out like on a Friday afternoon, and it was like all weekend. So I call my boss like, oh, I'm so sorry. We did this. Got to tell the CEO. She's like, no big deal. This happens. She said, I feel bad you lost sleep over it. We're normal. We're going to make mistakes, which was really helpful. So we wrote a new email. It had a mistake in it again. I even sent it to the legal department. They reviewed it. Another error. So like, and again, she was very supportive, but I've learned so much from those failures. And so that had to happen. But I think as a good mentor to me, she was like, the world doesn't come to them over an email. Like, that reminder to help me sleep at night was so helpful. And I think sometimes as a mentor, that's what we do. We just help put you back together. You made a mistake. It's not colossal. Here's how we're going to fix it. And I learned so much more from that than I learned from mistakes that never happened. Like, you assume it's right. You don't know. But that process of like double checking, knowing what my errors are, how to draft this email, you know, and in some ways her advice did work. She was like, we're running through legal. So the second time there was an error, it was helpful that I could say, well, legal reviewed it and they missed it too. Was super helpful, because at least I could say there was a process and I learned from this, how I'm going to use the process in the future. So it's okay to create space for people to fail. There's a lot of learning that's going to happen in there.
I love that. And I'll take those parenting tips as well. I've got a 6 and an 8-year-old, and I feel like I'm helicoptering over. Most times, I'm telling you, I take those tips for sure. Yeah. So we opened our call today, Jason, with a poll. And that poll, in essence, was around what you believe the most challenging aspect of finding a suitable mentor is. And 30% of people said finding someone who has the time or the willingness to mentor. So it's almost like all the great mentors are too busy, maybe, or the people that I've identified that I hope I'll be able to learn things from, I don't think I can carve time out of their schedules, their professional and personal lives, to get from them what I think I want to get from them. How do you respond to that, Jason? Do you think perhaps we need to change our perspective on what mentorship needs to look like from these people?
Yeah, you know, as a diversity professional, I'm like, mentoring can be diverse, can be in a lot of different forms. And like I said, for me personally, sometimes it wasn't a formal mentoring, you know, relationship. It was just, I'm just going to watch and observe that behavior, that there's so much that can be learned. Just how do they negotiate the room? You know, do they come early? They stay late? What do they say? When do they choose to say certain things? I just tried to take notes on that, because a lot of the mentorship I had wasn't necessarily this formal relationship. It was just me observing. And in some cases, even observing people I didn't like, because what I find is, but they're still successful. So, you know, I shouldn't just, like, there's different ways to get to leadership positions. And so I do think it's great if someone does have that formal time for you and they can do this. But if they can't, it doesn't mean it has to stop. I still was able to develop a relationship with the CEO. I don't know that he would ever say he was my mentor. But whenever like I mentioned, when I was in his space, I'll just start watching, how's he do things? If there's an event he was at, I'll try to see how he did it. And there's a lot of those opportunities. And I'm always observant of leaders who are in spaces where they're the only woman or they're the only person of color, because just observing them, you can pick up on cues on how they got themselves there. Is there always an agenda? What do they put on their agenda? How do they negotiate that agenda? You know, we had a leader at a university I worked at who I found somewhat abrasive, but then I realized, no, she realized it's a very male dominated room, and she was just getting on them before they could get to her. She just figured it out. And I realized, you know what? I have taken everyone else's assumption about her and not realized, no, if I just pause for a moment and watch what she's doing, she prevented a lot of people from, because it was a very kind of masculine, male dominated room that spent a lot of time demeaning her if they got the opportunity. So she just started getting ahead of it to the point where it just stopped altogether. And I realized what she was doing was brilliant. But if I had taken the first perspective that most people in the room did, oh, this person's abrasive and all that, I would have missed an opportunity to learn. And then I realized like some of these skill sets were brilliant. And then it helped me later too, because we have a different style. Like I wouldn't have been that aggressive, but at the same time, there were certain things she did that were helpful to me. Like I'm going to prevent this fight from even starts because I know I've seen how she did it and I see how she handles these people. And then I'm like, okay, yeah, my life has actually gotten easier too, because it's different, but the fundamental principle is the same. Like she's working that room and she knew how to, and she'd been very successful. You don't have to adopt it, you know, the exact same way. And we didn't have this mentorship relationship necessary, but I still had opportunity to learn from her. And I did.
That's good. That's really, really, really good, Jason. I'm thinking we may have people in that frame of mind of I'm mid-career, right? I've been doing this 10 years, 15 years, maybe even 20 years. And I'm wondering, how do I now approach mentorship? It might seem mentorship is packaged more readily when I'm early career and I'm sort of green and there's so many things that need to be pruned off and shaped and all these different things. But if I've been doing this for a while, you know, I have skin in the game professionally, now I'm mid-career and I might be feeling a little stuck.
Yes.
How do I approach mentorship at that stage?
Yeah, so this is what I would do. And you know, I worked at a hospital system for about 5 or 6 years, and I remember feeling a little stuck, you know, 35-ish kind of thing. And then I realized I'm a complete introvert, but I forced myself to have a lunch with a different leader every other week, which was hard. But I realized I didn't necessarily say I was having this form of mentorship, but you go to lunch, you have this casual conversation. I started developing relationships, and they would start telling me the history of the organization and their relationships to other people. And that relationship started helping me negotiate the organization better, you know, created my next opportunity. And so that's one thing I would do is in some ways, maybe it's not so much I got to have a mentor. It's like, I just got to force myself to have lunch with a different person every 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And a few of them started to become very close friends to me, you know, that because we just got into this thing. But they would share information with me. And again, I'm socially awkward. So the mentorship thing doesn't totally work perfectly for me. But I had to put myself in that position of, okay, call somebody, let's do lunch, right? And I learned a lot through that. And it was really helpful to me because they would share things also that they were doing in the org that I wasn't even aware of. Then you become part of this social network, which is really helpful too, especially when you feel like your career's stuck because they'll say inadvertently, oh, so-and-so's doing this or so-and-so's doing that. I'd be like, oh, I can, you know, there might be an opportunity for me there too. And so I think that's one of the things you could do formally is just start reaching out and starting trying to develop those relationships. And a lot of times I'd say, yeah, just trying to get to know people, you know, just do lunch. And you'd be surprised how people are just like, yeah, glad you called me. You know, it's actually not that complicated.
Yeah. Thanks so much for that, Jason. So how do I effectively navigate those challenges if those challenges come as a byproduct of a mentor or a mentee relationship? Some of the challenges they're trying to navigate corporate-wise seem to be connected to what are either hoped to be mentor-mentee relationships or current mentor-mentee relationships.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple things I would do. One is, it's okay to pause for a minute and maybe build some additional relationships. I think sometimes too, and this is one of the unintended consequences of a mentorship program, is people always look like they're trying to fix you, right? And as a result, when they're always trying to fix you, they don't become your sponsor. They're not actually putting you out there for your next opportunity. So in some cases, what you need to do is expand that network. And that might, like I said, it became to me as like, I just started having lunch with people, just start meeting other people. I have seen that happen. And from a diversity perspective, what I found is, and this is why I stopped doing formal development programs, because it always puts people of color in this less than dynamic, like, oh, you always got to be fixed. That's why you're in the pipeline program. And in fact, for most people of color, you don't need to be fixed. You need a network. That's the weakness, is you don't have a network, because that network will expose you to other opportunities. And so in many cases, you need to change the mindset. And I can see, and I can now I see the question being, it's that mentor always sees me as less than and always trying to fix me. And that could be the thing, is you actually need a sponsor. And you know, you made this point earlier too, right? Like there's a difference between a sponsor and a mentor. Mm-hmm. And if you want a mentor to be a sponsor, maybe they don't understand the difference. And that's why they keep mentoring you rather than being the sponsor, because you want them to advocate for you in different spaces. And you may need a different person to do that for you.
That was big. That was big. Oh, we've had a rich discussion today. I want to ask you, it's a diversity question. one that has arisen quite a bit in some of the work that I do. And I think it's one of the things we're still wrestling with in the space. And that's tokenism. I know that as a DEI professional, this is something you've gone through, you've navigated quite a bit, whether it's as the youngest person in the room. So, you know, we give you a voice because you're the youngest, or you represent the minority. And so we listen to you because you represent the minority, or we need to make sure there is, I'll put it this way, there's a bit of seasoning on the C-suite level. And so we throw your name in there, so that it isn't just all, you know, one dimensional or one note. But having you there or giving attention to your voice is completely different to listening to you and giving value to your contributions. So as men of color trying to navigate the corporate space, even seeking to build mentorship relationships, how do we navigate around what can feel like tokenism sometimes?
Yeah. And that's a good question. And I tend to be overly practical. And there's certain part of me is like, just accept it for what it is. They open the door for you, walk through, and make sure other people get a chance to walk through the door. You know, sometimes it's just because we're the first. And, you know, if you look historically, Jackie Robinson was the first. I mean, he broke the color line in baseball. If he hadn't done it, it would never happen. Like, he had to do that. Was he the token? Yes, he was. But it's what happened after. You know, he called out things when the opportunity was presented to him, tried to make sure the door was open for other athletes. And I think that's our obligation. You know, many times we are the token. That's just a fact. I also try to, when I see that in a corporation, is try to support my peers. You know, like many times, like they're the only woman. Like, how can we support each other? Like, we got to keep the door open for everybody. And I would say, you know, being a token isn't like I choose it. It's what's being done to me. Our only response to that is, how can I make this a better opportunity going forward? How can I make sure that I'm actually changing the organization? So when the door is open and my voice is heard, that I have to use that voice. That, you know, that's one of the hardest things about being the first, is that you are going to be by yourself, but hopefully you do in fact make change. And it comes with the territory. And many times we beat ourselves up over psychologically around that. And part of it is like, just own it and make change. Like, the door's open. You know, you can't change the world, but you can change this moment. Do the best you can with it. You know, I think we need to support each other too, because many times we look upon these people like, oh, there's a token, and we're doing the same thing. We're demeaning them when in fact they need our support. Like, it's very isolating. And I've always walked when people reached out and could see what was going on. Like, hey, Jason, what can I do? I was like, thank you. Like, that call's enough. Like, knowing that you see me struggling here is super helpful. And hopefully that's what we can do for each other.
Man, Jason, thank you so much. I think that was a masterclass.
Yeah, I appreciate
all that you've sort of poured into Arkahila Nights today. Really practical advice as well. And for men of color who are looking for actionable steps they can take to break through that corporate ceiling, almost to break through that glass ceiling and to climb the corporate mountain, we've got lots of gems and nuggets today. So Jason Thompson, PPDI, Western Governors University, long list of experience and credentials, but you really brought your value to us today, and we are incredibly grateful to you, sir. Jason, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you being here, and you know, hopefully I can come back. Thanks.
Definitely. We really appreciate you being here as well. Until next time, go out there and be great.
Thanks for listening. We appreciate you choosing to spend your time with us. If you love this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe. If you'd like more information on how we empower professionals mid-climb, visit our website at kahila.com. That's kahilla.com.
And as we say at Kahila, step up into your boldest self, and while you're up there, reach down and help another person up.